The quiet before the storm, Peanut said.
Ellie looked up from the stack of papers on her desk just in time to see her friend light up a cigarette.
I asked. You grunted, Peanut said before Ellie could argue.
Ellie didn't bother fighting. What about the storm?
It's the quiet before. Tomorrow all hell is going to break loose. I watch court TV, I know. Today there were a few local channels and papers here. One Flying Wolf Girl headline, and that will change. Every reporter in the country will want in on the story.
She shook her head, exhaling smoke and coughing.
That poor kid, how will we protect her?
I'm working on that.
And how will we trust whoever comes to claim her?
It was the question that haunted Ellie, the root of her disquiet. That's been bothering me from the get-go, P. I don't want to hand her over to the very people who hurt her, but I have damn little evidence. Gut instinct doesn't go far in today's legal system. I'm actually hoping there's a kidnapping report. How sad is that? I'd love to return a little girl who was outright stolen from her home. Then there might be blood samples and a suspect. If it's not that simple, she shrugged, I'll need some help from the big boys.
Without a crime, they'll stay away, like thieves from a lineup. They'll want you to do all the hard work. The state might step in, but only to warehouse her. They've already told us as much.
Ellie had ridden this merry-go-round of worries and outcomes all night. She was no closer to an answer now than when she climbed aboard. It's all up to Julia, I guess. If she can get a story out of the girl, we have a starting place.
If the girl can talk, you mean?
That's Julia's side of the problem. And if anyone can help that girl, it's my sister. Right now, our job is to find her a place to work.
Ellie tapped her pen on the desk.
Peanut started coughing again. Put that thing out, P. You're the worst smoker I've ever seen.
And I've actually gained a pound this week. I'm going back to eating only cabbage soup. Or maybe carrot sticks.
Peanut put out her cigarette.
Hey, how about the old sawmill? No one would look for her there.
Too cold. Too indefensible. Some wily tabloid photographer would find a way in. Four roads lead up to it. At least six doors would need to be guarded. And it's public property.
County hospital?
Too many employees. Sooner or later, someone would sell the story. Ellie frowned. What we need is a secret location and a cone of silence.
In Rain Valley? You must be joking. This town lives for gossip. Everyone will want to talk to the press.
Of course. The answer was so obvious, she didn't know how she'd missed it. This was just like that time in high school when they'd stolen the attendance sheet on senior skip day. Ellie had planned the whole thing. Call Daisy Grimm. Peanut glanced at the clock.
The Bachelor is on.
I don't care. Call her. I want everybody who is anybody in this town at a 6 a.m. meeting at the Congregational Church.
A town meeting? About what?
It's top secret.
A secret town meeting? And at dawn? How dramatic.
Peanut pulled a pen out from the ratted coil of her auburn hair.
What's the agenda?
The Flying Wolf Girl, of course. If this town wants to gossip, we'll give them something to talk about.
Ooh-wee! This is going to be fun!
For the next hour, Ellie worked on the plan, while Peanut called their friends and neighbors. By 10 o'clock, they were done. Ellie looked down at the contract she'd devised. It was perfect. I, blank, agree to keep any and all information about the Wolf Girl completely confidential. I swear I won't tell anyone anything that I learned at the town meeting in October. Rain Valley can count on me. Signature required.
It won't hold up in court, Peanut said, coming over to her.
Who are you, Perry Mason?
I watch Boston Legal and Law and Order.
Ellie rolled her eyes. It doesn't need to be legally binding. It just needs to seem like it is. What does this town love more than anything?
Parade.
Ellie had to concede that point. Okay, second most.
Two-for-one sale?
Gossip, she said, realizing Peanut could make guesses until dawn. And secrets. She stood up and reached for her coat. The only problem will be Julia.
Why is that?
She's not going to like the idea of a town meeting.
Why not?
You remember how it was for her in town. No one knew what to make of her. She walked around with her nose in a book. She never talked to anyone but our mom.
That was a long time ago. She won't care what people think of her now. She's a doctor, for cripe's sake.
She'll care, Ellie said with a sigh. She always did. He is deep in a green darkness. Overhead, leaves rustle in an invisible breeze. Clouds mask the silvery moon. There is only the sheen of light. Perhaps it is a memory. The girl is crouched on a branch, watching him. She is so still that he wonders how his gaze found her. Hey, he whispers, reaching out. She drops to the leaf-carpeted floor without a sound. On all fours, she runs away. He finds her in a cave, bound and bleeding. Afraid, he thinks he hears her say, "Help," and then she is gone. There is a little boy in her place, blonde-haired. He is reaching out, crying.
Max came awake with a start. For a moment he had no idea where he was. All he saw around him were pale pink walls and ruffles, a collection of glass figurines on a shelf, elves and wizards. There was a vase full of silk roses on the bedside table and two empty wine glasses. Trudy. She lay beside him, sleeping. In the moonlight, her naked back looked almost pure white. He couldn't help reaching out. At his touch, she rolled over and smiled up at him.
"You're going?" she whispered, her voice throaty and low.
He nodded. She angled up to her elbows, revealing the swell of her bare breasts above the pink blanket.
"What is it, Max? All night you were distracted."
"The girl," he said simply. She reached out, traced his cheekbone with her long fingernail.
"I thought so. I know how much hurt kids get to you."
"Picked a hell of a career, didn't I?"
"Sometimes a person can care too much."
In the uncertain light, he thought she looked sad, but he couldn't be sure.
"You could talk to me, you know."
"Talking isn't what we do best. That's why we get along so well."
"We get along because I don't want to be in love."
He laughed.
"And I do."
She smiled knowingly.
"See you, Max."
He kissed her shoulder, then bent down for his clothes. When he was dressed, he leaned closer to her and whispered, "Bye." And then he left. Within minutes, he was on his motorcycle and racing down the black, empty expanse of road. He almost turned onto the old highway. Then he remembered why he'd left Trudy's house in the first place. The dream he'd had. His patient. He thought about that poor girl all alone in her room. Kids were afraid of the dark. He changed directions and hit the gas. At the hospital, he parked beside Penelope Nutter's battered red pickup and went inside. The hallways were empty and quiet, with only a few nighttime nurses on duty. The usual noises were gone, leaving him nothing to hear save the metronome patter of his footsteps. He stopped by the nurse's station to get the girl's chart and check on her progress.
"Hey, doctor,"
said the nurse on duty. She sounded as tired as he felt. Max leaned against the counter and smiled.
"Now, Janet, how many times have I asked you to call me Max?"
She giggled and blushed.
"Too many."
Max patted her plump hand. Years ago, when he'd first met Janet, all he'd seen was her Tammy Faye fake eyelashes and Marge Simpson hair. Now, when she smiled, he saw the kind of goodness that most people didn't believe in.
I'll keep hoping.
Listening to her girlish laughter, he headed for the daycare center. There he peered through the window, expecting to see the girl curled up on the mattress on the floor, asleep in the darkness. Instead, the lights were on, and Julia was there, sitting on a tiny chair beside a child-sized formica table. There was a notebook open on her lap and a tape recorder on the table near her elbow. Although he could only see her profile, she appeared utterly calm. Serene, even. The girl, on the other hand, was agitated. She darted around the room, making strange, repetitive hand gestures. Then, all at once, she stopped dead and swung to face Julia. Julia said something. Max couldn't hear it through the glass. The words were muffled. The girl blew snot from her nose and shook her head. When she started to scratch her own cheeks, gouging the flesh, Julia lunged at her, took her in her arms. The girl fought like a cat, but Julia hung on. They stumbled sideways, fell down on the mattress. Julia held the girl immobile, ignoring the snot flying and head shaking. Then Julia started to sing. He could tell by the cadence of her voice, the way the sounds blended into one another. He went to the door and quietly opened it, just a crack. The girl immediately looked at him and stilled, snorting in fear. Julia sang, "Tale as old as time, song as old as rhyme." He stood there, mesmerized by the sound of her voice. Julia held the girl and stroked her hair and kept singing. Not once did she even glance toward the door. Slowly, the minutes ticked by. Beauty and the Beast gave way to other songs. First, it was "I'm a Lonely Little Petunia in the Onion Patch," and then "Somewhere Over the Rainbow," and then "Puff the Magic Dragon." Gradually, the girl's eyelashes fluttered shut, reopened. The poor thing was trying so hard to stay awake. Julia kept singing. Finally, the girl put her thumb in her mouth, started sucking it, and fell asleep. Very gently, Julia tucked her patient into bed and covered her with blankets, then went back to the table to gather her notes. Max knew he should back away now, leave before she noticed him, but he couldn't move. The sound of her voice had captured him somehow, as had the glimmer of pale moonlight on her hair and skin. "I guess this means you like watching," she said without looking at him. He would have sworn that she'd never once glanced at the door, but she'd known he was there. He stepped into the room. "You don't miss much, do you?" She put the last of the papers in her briefcase and looked up. Her skin appeared ashen beneath the dim lighting. The scratches on her cheeks were dark and angry. A yellow bruise marred her forehead, but it was her eyes that got to him.
"I miss plenty."
Her voice was so soft it took him a second to really hear what she'd said. "I miss plenty." She was talking about that patient of hers, the one that killed those children in Silverwood and then committed suicide. He knew about that kind of guilt. "You look like a woman who could use a cup of coffee."
"Coffee? At 1 o'clock in the morning? I don't think so, but thank you."
She sidled past him, then herded him out of the daycare center and shut the door behind him. "How about pie?" he said as she headed down the hallway. "Pie is good any time of the day." She stopped, turned around.
"Pie?"
He moved toward her, unable to keep from smiling.
"I knew I could tempt you."
She laughed at that, and though it was a tired, not quite genuine sound, it made his smile broaden.
"The pie,"
tempted me. He led her to the cafeteria and flipped on the lights. In this quiet time of night, the place was empty. The cases and buffets were bare. "Take a seat." Max eased around the sandwich counter and went back into the kitchen, where he found 2 pieces of marionberry pie, which he covered with vanilla ice cream. Then he made 2 cups of herb tea and carried a tray out into the dining room and set it down on the table in front of Julia. "Chamomile tea, to help you sleep," he said, sliding into the booth seat opposite her. "And marionberry pie, a local favorite." He handed her a fork. She stared at him, frowning slightly. "Thanks," she said after a pause.
"You're welcome."
"So, Dr. Saracen," she said after another long silence, "do you make a habit of luring colleagues down to the cafeteria for early morning pie?" He smiled.
"Well, if by colleagues you mean doctors, there aren't exactly a lot of us. To be honest, I haven't taken old Doc Fisher out for pie in ages."
"How about the nurses?"
He heard a tone in her voice and looked up. She was eyeing him over the beige porcelain of her cup, assessing him.
"It sounds to me like you're asking about my love life."
He smiled. "Is that it, Julia?"
"Love life?" She put a slight emphasis on love. "Do you have one of those? I would be surprised."
He frowned.
"You sure think you know me?"
She took a bite of pie.
"Let's just say I know your kind."
"No, let's not say that. Whoever you're confusing me with is not sitting at this table. You just met me, Julia."
"Fair enough. Why don't you tell me about yourself, then? Are you married?"
"An interesting first question."
"No."
"Are you?"
"No."
"Ever been married?"
"No."
"Ever get close?"
She glanced down for a second. It was all he needed to know. Someone had broken her heart. He'd bet that it was fairly recent. "Yes." "How about you? Have you ever been married?"
"Once. A long time ago."
That seemed to surprise her. "Kids?"
"No."
She looked at him sharply, as if she'd heard something in his voice. Their gazes held. Finally, she smiled. "So, I guess you can have pie with anyone you'd like?"
"I can."
"You've probably had pie with every woman in town."
"You give me too much credit. Married women make their own pie."
"And how about my sister?"
His smile faded. Suddenly, the flirting didn't seem so harmless.
"What about her?"
"Have you had pie with her?"
"A gentleman wouldn't really answer that, now would he?"
"So you're a gentleman?"
"Of course."
He was becoming uncomfortable with the course of their conversation. "How is your face feeling? That bruise is getting uglier."
"We shrinks get popped now and then, hazards of the trade."
"You can never quite know what a person will do, can you?"
Her gaze met his.
"Knowing is my job, although by now the whole world knows I missed something important."
There was nothing he could say, no real comfort he could give, so he stayed quiet.
"No platitudes, Dr. Saracen? No, God doesn't give you more than you can bear, speech?"
"Call me Max. Please."
He looked at her. "And sometimes, God breaks your fucking back." It was a long moment before she said,
"How did he break you, Max?"
He slid out of the booth and stood beside her.
"As much as I'd love to keep chatting, I have to be at work at 7, so..."
Julia put the dishes on the tray and slid from the booth. Max took the tray to the kitchen and put the dishes in the dishwasher. Then they walked side by side through the quiet, empty hallways and out to the parking lot.
I'm driving the red truck, she said, digging through her purse for the keys. Max opened the door for her. She looked up at him. Thanks. You're welcome. She paused, then said, No more pie for me. Just so you know. Okay? He frowned. But thanks again. She got in the truck, slammed the door shut, and drove away. 8. Julia refused to let herself think about Max. She had enough on her mind right now without obsessing over some small-town hunk. So what if he intrigued her? Max was definitely a player, and she had no interest in games or the kind of man who played them. That was a lesson Philip had taught her. She turned onto Olympic Drive. This was the oldest part of town, built back in the 30s for the families of mill workers. Driving through here was like going back in time. She came to a stop at the T in the road, and there it was, caught in her headlights. The lumber store. In this middle-of-night hour, she couldn't read the orange banner that hung in the window. Still, she knew the words by heart. This community is supported by timber. Those same banners had been strung throughout town since the Spotted Owl days. This store was the heart of the West End. In the summer, it opened as early as 3 o'clock in the morning. And at that, men like her father were already there and waiting impatiently to get started on their day. She eased her foot off the accelerator and coasted through a haze of fog. So often she'd sat in her dad's pickup outside this store, waiting for him. He'd been a cutter, her dad. A cutter was to an ordinary logger what a thoracic surgeon was to a general practitioner. The cream of the crop. He'd gone into the woods early, long before his buddies. Alone. Always alone. His friends, other cutters, died so often it stopped being a surprise. But he'd loved strapping spurs onto his ankles, grabbing a rope, and scaling a 200-foot-tall tree. Of course, it was an adventurer's job. Near death every day, and the money to match the risk. They'd all known it was only a matter of time before it killed him. She hit the gas too hard. The old truck lurched forward, bucked, and died. Julia started it up again, found first gear, and headed out to the old highway. No wonder she'd stayed at the hospital so late. She'd told herself it was about the girl, about doing a great job, but that was only part of it. She'd been putting off going back to the house, where there were too many memories. She parked the truck and went inside. The house was full of shapes and shadows, all of which were familiar. Ellie had left the stairwell light on for her. It was the same thing Mom had always done, and the sight of it, that soft golden light spilling down the worn oak stairs, filled her heart with longing. Her mother had always waited up for her. Never in this house had she gone to bed without a nighttime kiss. No matter how badly Mom and Dad were fighting, she always got her kiss from Mom. Julia was 13 years old, the first time she'd seen through the veil. At least, that was how she now thought of it. In one day, she'd gone from believing her family was happy to knowing the truth. Her mother had come in that night with bloodshot eyes and tear-stained cheeks. Julia had only asked a few questions before Mom started to talk. It's your father, she'd whispered. I shouldn't tell you, but... Those next few words were like well-placed charges. They blew Julia's family and her world apart. The worst part was, Mom never told Ellie the same things. Julia went up the stairs. In the tiny second-floor bathroom that attached to her girlhood bedroom, she brushed her teeth, washed her face, and slipped into the silk pajamas she'd brought with her from Beverly Hills, then went into her old room. There was a note on her pillow. In Ellie's bold handwriting, it read, "Meeting at Congregational Church at 6 a.m. to discuss girls' placement. Be ready to leave at 5:45.
Good. Her sister was working on it.
Julia stayed up another hour, filling out all the paperwork required to be appointed temporary foster parent for the child. Then she climbed into bed and clicked off the light. She was asleep almost instantly. At 4 o'clock, she woke with a start. For a second, she didn't know where she was. Then she saw the ballerina music box on her white desk, and it all came back to her. She remembered her dream, too. She'd been a girl again. That girl. The scarecrow-thin, socially awkward daughter of Big Tom Cates. She threw the covers off her and stumbled out of bed. Within minutes, she was in her jogging clothes and outside, running down the old highway past the entrance to the national park. By 5:15, she was back home, breathing hard, feeling like her grown-up self again. Pale gray pre-dawn light, as watery as everything else in this rainforest climate, shone in flashlight beams through the stand of hemlock trees that grew along the river. She didn't decide to move, didn't want to, but before she knew it, she was walking across the yard to the river.
"Move back a little bit. Out of my way. I can hardly concentrate on my fishing with you skulking beside me."
No wonder she had moved away from here and stayed away. The memories were everywhere. Like the trees, they seemed to draw nutrients from the land and the rain. She turned and went back into the house. Julia and Ellie were the first to arrive. They pulled up into a spot near the church's front door and got out of the car. Ellie started to say something, but the words were lost in the crunching sound of wheels on gravel. A snake of cars rolled into the parking lot, lining up side by side. The doors opened. People poured out. They were all talking at once. Their voices were loud and scratchy, competitive. Each one wanted their opinion heard. Earl and Myra were the first people out of their car. Earl was in full dress uniform, but his wife had on fuzzy pink sweats. Her hair was up in rollers and covered by a bright scarf. Ellie took Julia by the arm and hurried her into the church. The door clanged shut behind them. Julia couldn't help feeling a twinge of nerves. It pissed her off, that weakness. None of this old crap should bother her now. It wouldn't have, if she'd come home in triumph instead of shame. "I don't care what they think anymore. I really don't. So why... I never understood why you let it all get to you. Who cares if they don't like you?" "Girls like you can't understand," Julia said. And it was true. Ellie had always been popular. She didn't know that some hurts were like a once-broken bone. In the right weather, they could ache for a lifetime. The doors banged open, and people rushed into the church, took their places in the rows of oak pews. Their voices combined, rose, sounded like a Cuisinart on high, crushing ice. Max was one of the last to arrive. He took a seat in the back. Ellie went to the pulpit. She waited until 6:10, then motioned for Peanut to shut and lock the doors. It took her another 5 minutes to quiet the crowd. "Thank you all for coming," she said finally. "I know how early it is, and I appreciate your cooperation."
"What's this all about, Ellie?" someone asked from the back of the room. "Our shift starts in 40 minutes. "Shut up, Doug," yelled someone else. "Let her talk." "You shut up, Al. It's about the flying wolf girl, right, Ellie?"
Ellie held up her hands for silence. They quieted. "It's about the girl who arrived recently." The crowd erupted again, hurling questions at the podium. "Can she really fly?
Where is she? Where's the wolf?"
Julia was awed by her sister's patience. There was no eye-rolling, no sneering, no fist-pounding. She simply said, "The wolf is with Floyd at the Olympic Game Farm. He's being well cared for."
I heard the girl eats with her feet, someone called out.
And only raw meat.
Ellie took a deep breath. It was the first sign that she was losing her cool.
Look, we don't have long to get ourselves together. The point is this. Do we want to protect this child?
A resounding yes rose from the crowd.
Good.
She turned to Peanut. Hand out the contracts. To the crowd, she said,
I'm going to read off your names. Please answer so I know you're here.
Ellie read off the names in alphabetical order, starting with Herb Adams. One by one, people responded, until she came to Mort Elzick. There was no answer.
He ain't here,
Earl yelled.
Okay, Ellie said. We don't mention this meeting, or the girl, to Mort, or to anyone else who isn't at this meeting. Agreed?
Agreed, they responded in unison. But what is it we ain't saying, Ellie? Yeah, speed it up. I got a charter in 30 minutes. And the mill's gonna open.
Ellie held up her hands for silence. Fair enough. As you all know by now, my sister, Julia, has come home to help. What she needs is peace and quiet and a place to work away from the media. Daisy Grimm stood up. She wore denim overalls that were covered with appliqué daisies. Her drugstore makeup was so bright against her powdered cheeks that it probably glowed in the dark.
Can your sister really help this poor girl? I mean, after what happened in California, I just wonder.
The crowd went still, waiting.
Sit down, Daisy, Ellie said sharply. Now, here's the plan. It's a version of Hide the Walnut. We are all going to talk to the media. When asked, we're going to secretly and off the record tell where the girl is staying. You can tell them any place you want, except my house. That's where she'll be. They won't trespass on the police chief's land, and if they do, Jake and Elwood will give us warning.
We're lying to the press? Violet said in awe.
We are. Hopefully we can send them all on wild goose chases until we know the girl's name. And one other thing. No one mentions Julia. No one.
Lying,
Marigold said, trembling like an excited puppy and clapping her hands together. This will be fun.
Just remember, Ellie said, until you hear differently from me, we're lying to Mort, too. No one outside this building gets to know the truth.
Violet burst out laughing.
You can count on us, Ellie. Those reporters will be looking for the girl as far north as the Yukon. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I never heard of Dr. Julia Cates. I believe the poor child is seeing Dr. Welby.
9. While Ellie was parking the car, Julia went into the hospital. She was almost at the old daycare center when she turned the corner and ran into a man. He stumbled back from her, sputtering,
Watch where you're going, I'm...
Julia bent down for the black canvas bag he'd dropped. I'm sorry, I'm in a bit of a hurry. Are you okay? He snatched the bag from her and then looked up. She frowned. He looked vaguely familiar, with his rust-colored crew cut and Coke bottle glasses. Do I know you?
Nope, sorry,
he mumbled, glancing away quickly. Without another word, he took off running down the hallway. She sighed. People had been doing that a lot lately. No one quite knew how to treat her since the media frenzy and the Silverwood tragedy. She picked up her briefcase and walked down the hallway to the daycare center. A few minutes later, Peanut, Max, and Ellie arrived. They stood at the window outside the daycare center, looking in. The room was full of shadows. Pockets of light grew like mushrooms above the nightlights in the various outlets, and a pale golden haze fanned down from the only ceiling fixture they'd left on. The girl lay on the floor, curled up, with her arms wrapped around her shins. The mattress, empty save for the pile of unused blankets, was beside her. From this distance, and without benefit of good lighting, she appeared to be asleep.
"She knows we're watching her," Peanut said.
Ellie said, "She looks asleep to me."
"She's too still," Julia said.
"Peanut's right." Peanut made a tisking sound.
"Poor thing. How do we move her without terrifying her?"
"We put a sedative in her apple juice," Max said.
He turned to Julia. "Can you get her to drink it?"
"I think so."
"Good," he said. "Let's try that. If it doesn't work, we'll go to Plan B."
"What's Plan B?"
Peanut asked, her eyes wide.
"A shot."
30 minutes later, Julia went into the daycare center, flipping on the lights as she went. Although the team had moved away from the window, she knew they were standing in the shadows, watching her through the glass. The girl didn't move a finger or bat an eyelash. She simply lay there, coiled up like a snail, holding her legs close to her chest.
"I know you're awake," Julia said conversationally.
She set down her tray on the table. On it was a plate filled with scrambled eggs and toast. A green plastic sippy cup held apple juice. She sat down on the child-sized chair and ate a bite of toast.
This is good, but it makes me thirsty."
She pretended to take a sip. Nothing. No reaction. Julia sat there for almost 30 minutes, pretending to eat and drink, talking out loud to the child who didn't respond. Every second bothered her. They needed to move this girl fast before the press came looking for her here. Finally, she pushed back from the table. The chair legs screeched against the linoleum floor. Before Julia knew what had happened, all hell broke loose. The girl screamed. She jumped to her feet and started clawing at her face and blowing her nose.
"It's okay," Julia said evenly. "You're upset. Scared. You know that word? You're scared. That's all. It was a loud, ugly noise, and it scared you. That's all. You're fine. See how quiet everything is?"
Julia moved toward the girl, who was standing in the corner, thumping her forehead against the wall.
Thud, thud, thud.
Julia winced at each blow.
"You're upset, scared. That's okay. The noise scared me, too."
Very slowly, Julia reached out, touched the child's rail-thin shoulder.
"Shh," she said.
The girl went totally still. Julia could feel the tension in the girl's shoulder and back, the tightening up.
"You are okay now. Okay. No hurt. No hurt."
She touched the girl's other shoulder and gently turned her around. The girl stared up at her through wary blue-green eyes. A purplish bruise was already forming on her forehead, and the scratches on her cheeks were bleeding. At this proximity, the smell of urine was almost overwhelming.
"No hurt,"
Julia said again, expecting the girl to pull free and run. But she stood there, breathing like a deer caught between two headlights, too fast, her whole body trembling. She was weighing the situation, cataloging her options.
"You're trying to read me," Julia said, surprised, "just like I'm trying to read you. I'm Julia."
She patted her chest.
"Julia."
The girl glanced away, disinterested. The trembling in her body eased. Her breathing regulated.
"No hurt," Julia said. food. Hungry?
The girl looked at the table, and Julia thought, Bingo! You know what I said. What I meant, anyway.
Eat, she said, finally letting go and stepping aside.
The girl sidled past her, moving cautiously, never taking her gaze off Julia's face. When there was a safe distance between them, the girl pounced on the food. She washed it all down with the apple juice. After that, Julia waited. Their early morning journey from town to the edge of the deep woods had the hazy feel of a dream. In the miles from the hospital to the old highway, no one spoke. For Max, there was something about this clandestine rescue that precluded the luxury of talk. He assumed it was the same for his co-conspirators, for although they told themselves this move was in the girl's best interest, and indeed believed it, there was still a nagging worry, an unbound thread. At least, at the hospital, she was safe. The door locked. The glass was too thick to break. Here, in the last stretch of valley before the big trees, the world outside was too close. None of them doubted that those woods would beckon her. He was in the back seat of the police cruiser, with Julia seated to his right. The girl lay between them, with her head in Julia's lap, her bare feet in his. In the front seat, Ellie and Peanut sat in silence. Except for the sound of their breathing and the crunching of the tires on thick gravel, the only sound came from the radio. It was turned down so quietly it could hardly be heard at all, but every now and then Max caught a stanza or two and recognized a song. Right now it was Superman by Crash Test Dummies. He looked down at the girl in his lap. She was so incredibly thin and frail. Today's scratches marred her cheeks, but even in this half-light he could see the silvery scars of older scratches, evidence that she'd often attacked herself or been attacked. The bruise on her forehead was purple now, angry-looking, but it was the scarring on her left ankle that made his stomach tighten, the ligature marks.
"We're here," Ellie said from the front seat as she parked beneath an old shake lean-to. Moss turned the slanted roof into a patch of green fur.
Max scooped the sleeping child into his arms. Her arms curled around his neck. She pressed her wrecked cheek against his chest. Her black hair fell sideways over his arm, almost to his thighs. He knew exactly how to hold her. How was it that even after all these years, it still felt as natural as breathing? Ellie hurried on ahead and turned on the exterior lights. Max carried the girl toward the house. Julia fell into step beside him.
"You're still safe," she said to the girl. "We're outside now, at my parents' house. Safe here, I promise."
From somewhere deep in the woods, a wolf howled. Max stopped. Julia did the same. Peanut made the sign of the cross.
"I am not feeling good about this."
"I've never heard a wolf out here," Ellie said. "It can't be her wolf. He's over in Squim."
The girl moaned. The wolf howled again. An undulating, elegiac sound. Julia touched his shoulder. "Come on, Max. Let's get her inside." No one spoke as they walked through the house, up the stairs and into the bedroom. Max put the child on the bed and covered her with blankets. Peanut glanced nervously at the window, as if the wolf were out there pacing the yard, looking for a way in.
"She's gonna try to escape. Those are her woods."
So they were all thinking the same thing. Somehow, as impossible as it sounded, the child belonged out there more than she did in here.
"Here's what we need, and fast," Julia said.
Bars, not skinny ones, on the window, so she can see outside but can't escape. And a deadbolt for the door. We need to cover every scrap of shiny metal with adhesive tape. The faucet, the toilet handle, the drawer pulls, everything except the doorknob.
Why? Peanut asked.
I think she's afraid of shiny metal, Julia answered distractedly. And we'll need a video camera set up as surreptitiously as possible. I'll need to record her condition.
I thought you said no pictures, Ellie said, frowning.
That was for the tabloids. This is for me. I need to observe her 24/7. We need food, too, and lots of tall houseplants. I want to turn one corner of the room into a forest.
Where the wild things are, Peanut said. Julia nodded, then went to the bed and sat down beside the girl.
Max followed her.
Kneeling beside the bed, he checked the girl's pulse and breathing. Normal, he said, sitting back on his heels.
If only her mind and her heart were as easy to read as her vital signs, Julia said.
You'd be out of a job.
Julia surprised him by laughing. They looked at each other. The bedside lamp flickered on and off, sparking electricity. The girl on the bed made a whining, desperate sound.
There's something weird going on here, Peanut said, stepping back.
Don't do that, Julia said quietly. She's just a child who has been through hell.
Peanut fell silent.
We should go to town, get supplies from the lumber store, Ellie said.
Max nodded. I have time to put up the bars before my shift.
Good. Thanks, Julia said.
When they were gone, she remained at her place by the bed.
You're safe here, little one. I promise. Julia said it over and over again, keeping her voice as gentle as a caress. But through it all, there was one thing she knew for certain. This girl had no idea what it meant to be safe.
Gone is the bad smell and the white hissing light that stings her eyes. Girl opens her eyes slowly, afraid of what she will see. There have been too many changes. It is as if she has fallen in the dark water past her place, that pool in the deep forest that him said was the start of out there.
This cave is different. Everything is the color of snow and of the berries she picks in early summer. It is morning outside. The light in the room is sun-colored. She starts to get up, but can't move. Something is holding her down. She panics, kicking and flailing to be free. But she is not tied. She moves out of the soft place and crouches on the ground, sniffing the scents of this strange place. Wood. Flowers. There is more, of course, many smells, but she doesn't know them. Somewhere, water is dripping. It sounds like the last rain falling from a leaf to the hard summer's ground. There is a banging, clanging sound, too. The entrance to this cave is like the last one, a thick brown thing. There is something about the shiny ball on it that is the source of its magic. She is afraid to touch it. The strangers would know then that she was wide-eyed. They would come for her again with their nets and their sharp points. She is safe from them only in the dark time when the sun sleeps. A breeze floats past her face, ruffles her hair. On it is the scent of her place. She looks around. There it is! The box that holds the wind. It is not like the other one, the trickster box that kept the outside out, through which you couldn't touch. She moves forward, holding her stomach tightly. Sweet air comes through the box. She carefully puts her hand through the opening. She moves slowly, a bit at a time, ready to pull back at the first sharp pain. But Nothing stops her. Finally, her whole arm is out there, in her world, where the air seems to be made of raindrops. She closes her eyes. For the first time since they trapped her, she can breathe. She lets out a long, desperate howl. Come for me, that noise means. But she stops in the middle of it. She is so far away from her cave. There is no one to hear her. This is why Him always told her to stay. He knew the world beyond her chain. Out there is full of strangers who will hurt girl. And she is alone now.
Years ago, Ellie had gone to the drive-in with her then-boyfriend, Scott Lauk, and seen a movie called Ants. Or maybe it had been Swarm. She wasn't entirely sure now. All she really remembered was a scene with Joan Collins being swarmed by Volkswagen-sized ants. Ellie, of course, had been more interested in making out with Scotty than watching the movie. Still, it was those long-ago film images that came to her now as she stood in the hallway outside the lunchroom, sipping her coffee and looking out at the melee in the station. It was a hive of people. From her place at the end of the hall, she couldn't see a patch of floor or a sliver of wall. It was the same way outside and down the block. The story had broken this morning under a variety of headlines. The Girl from Nowhere. Who am I? Remember me? And Ellie's particular favorite, this from Mort in the Gazette, Lying Mute Lands in Rain Valley. His first paragraph described the girl's prodigious leaping capabilities and, naturally, her wolf companion. His description of her was the only accurate report. He made her sound crazy, wild, and heartbreakingly pathetic. At 8 a.m., the first call had come in. Cal hadn't had a moment's peace since then. By 1 o'clock, the first national news van had pulled into town. Within 2 hours, the streets were jammed with vans and reporters demanding another press conference. Everyone, from journalists to parents to kooks and psychics, wanted to get the scoop firsthand.
So far, nothing has panned out, Peanut said, coming out of the lunchroom. No one knows who she is.
Ellie sipped her coffee and eyed the crowd. Cal looked up from his desk and saw the two of them. He was talking into the dispatch headset at the same time he fielded questions from the crowd of reporters in front of him. Ellie smiled at him. He mouthed, "Help me."
"Cal's losing it," Peanut said.
"I can hardly blame him. He didn't take this job to actually work."
"Who did?" Peanut said, laughing.
"That would be me." Ellie looked at her friend, said, "Wish me luck," and then waded back into the sea of clamoring, shouting reporters. In their midst, she raised her hands in the air. It took a long time to quiet them. Finally, she got their attention. "There will be no more comments, either on or off the record, by anyone in this office today. We'll conduct a press conference at 6 o'clock. And answer everything then." Chaos erupted.
"But we need photos.
These artist renderings are crap.
Drawings don't sell papers."
Ellie shook her head, exasperated. "I don't know how my sister..."
"That's it!"
Peanut barreled into the crowd, using the come-to-Jesus voice she'd perfected when Tara, her daughter, turned 13.
"You heard the chief. Everyone out. Now."
Peanut herded them out, then slammed the door shut. It wasn't until Ellie turned toward her desk that she saw him. Mort Elzik was standing in the corner, wedged between two industrial green metal file cabinets.
He was pale and sweaty-looking in his brown, wide-whale corduroy pants and navy blue golf shirt. His red crew cut was so long it looked like a fringed pompadour. Behind thick glasses, his eyes looked huge and watery. When he saw her looking at him, he moved forward. His worn white and gray tennis shoes squeaked with every step.
You need to give me an exclusive, Ellie. This is my big break. I could get a job with the Olympian or the Everett Herald.
With a Mowgli Lives headline? I doubt it.
He flushed.
What would a junior college dropout know about the classics? I know Julia is helping on this case.
You think she is. Put it in print, and I'll bury you.
His pale eyebrows beetled. His face turned red.
Give me an exclusive, Ellie. You owe it to me. Or...
Or what?
She moved closer.
Or else.
Mention my sister, and I'll get you fired.
He stepped back.
You think you're something special. But you can't get your way all the time. I gave you a chance. You remember that.
On that, he pushed past her and ran out of the station.
Praise Jesus and pass the ice, Cal said.
He went down to the lunchroom and came back with three beers.
You can't drink in here, Cal, Ellie said tiredly.
Bite me, he said, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. If I'd wanted an actual job, I wouldn't have answered your ad. I haven't been able to read a comic book in peace all week.
He handed her a Corona.
No thanks, Peanut said when he offered her a beer.
She went into the lunchroom, then came back out holding a mug. Ellie looked at her friend.
Cabbage soup, Peanut said, shrugging.
Cal sat on his desk, feet swinging, and drank his beer. His Adam's apple slid up and down his throat like a swallowed fishbone. His black hair reflected the light in waves of blue.
Good for you, P. I was afraid you were going to try the heroin diet next.
Peanut laughed.
To be honest, that smoking really sucked. Benji wouldn't even kiss me goodnight. And you two were always making out, Cal said.
Ellie heard something in Cal's voice. A rawness that confused her. She looked at him. For a moment she saw him as he used to be, a gawky kid with features too sharp for childhood. His eyes had always been shadowed then, full of wariness. He set his beer down and sighed. For the first time she noticed how tired he looked. His mouth, usually curled in an irritatingly buoyant smile, was a thin, pale line.
She couldn't help feeling sorry for him. She knew exactly what the problem was.
Cal had worked for her now for 2.5 years, full time. Before that, he'd been an at-home dad. His wife, Lisa, was a sales rep for a New York company and was gone more than she was home. When the kids were all in school, Cal took the dispatch job to fill the empty hours while they were gone. Mostly he read comic books during the day and drew action figures in his sketch pad. He was a good dispatcher, as long as the biggest emergency was a cat stuck in a tree. The past few days seemed to have undone him. She realized how much she missed his smile.
I'll tell you what, Cal. I'll handle the press conference. You go on home.
He looked pathetically hopeful. Still, he said,
You need someone to answer the emergency calls.
Forward the calls to the service. If something's important, they'll radio me. It'll only be the 911 calls, anyway.
You're sure? I could come back after Emily's soccer game.
That would be great.
Thanks, Ellie.
He finally grinned. It made him look about 17 years old again.
I'm sorry I gave you the finger this morning.
It's fine, Cal. Sometimes a man just has to make his point.
It was what her father used to say whenever he banged his fist on the kitchen table. Cal plucked his department-issue rain slicker off the antler hook and left the station. Ellie returned to her desk and sat down. To her left was a stack of faxes at least 2 inches tall,
Each sheet of paper represented a lost child, a grieving family. She'd gone through them carefully, highlighted the similarities and the distinctions. As soon as the press conference was over, she'd start calling the various agencies and officers back. No doubt she'd be on the phone all night.
"You're getting that faraway look again," Peanut said, sipping her soup.
"Just thinking."
Peanut set down her mug. "You can do it, you know. You're a great cop."
Ellie wanted to agree with that wholeheartedly. On any other day, she would have. But now she couldn't help glancing at the small stack of evidence they'd gathered on the girl's identity. There were 4 photographs. A face shot, a profile close-up, and 2 body shots. In each, the girl was so sedated she looked dead. The press would have a field day with them. Below the stack of 8x10s was a list of the girl's scars, identifying moles, and, of course, the birthmark on her back shoulder. In the photograph that accompanied the list, the birthmark looked remarkably like a dragonfly. The record also included X-rays. Max estimated that her left arm had been broken when she was quite young. He believed it had healed without professional medical treatment. Each injury, scar, and birthmark had been marked on a diagram of her body. They had taken blood samples. She was type AB. Fingerprints and dental X-rays. Her blood had been sent off for DNA analysis, but that report wasn't back yet. Her dress had also been sent away for analysis. There was nothing for them to do now except wait and pray that someone came forward to identify the girl. "I don't know, P. This is a tough one."
"You're up to it."
Ellie smiled at her friend. "Of all the decisions I've made in this job, you know what was the best one?"
"The drive a drunk home program?"
"Close. It was hiring you, Penelope Nutter."
She grinned. "Every star needs a sidekick."
Laughing, Ellie went back to work, reading through the pile of documents on her desk. A few moments later, there was a knock at the door. Peanut looked up.
"Who knocks at a police station?"
Ellie shrugged. "Not a reporter." "Come in," she said loudly. Slowly, the door opened. A couple stood on the front step, peering inside.
"Are you Chief Barton?" asked the man.
They weren't reporters, that much was certain. The man was tall and white-haired, thin to the point of gauntness. He wore a pale gray cashmere sweater and black pants with knife-sharp pleats, and big-city shoes. The woman, his wife, was dressed in black from head to toe. Black coat dress, black hose, black pumps. Her hair, an expensive trio of blondes, was drawn back from her pale face and coiled in a French twist. Ellie stood. "Come on in." The man touched the woman's elbow, guided her to Ellie's desk.
"Chief Barton, I'm Dr. Isaac Stern. This is my wife, Barbara."
Ellie shook both of their hands, noticing how cold their skin was. "It's nice to meet you."
A blast of wind hit the open door, made it smack hard against the wall.
"Excuse me," Ellie went to shut the door. "How can I help you?"
Dr. Stern looked at her.
"I'm here about my daughter, Ruthie. Our daughter," he corrected, looking at his wife. "She disappeared in 1996. There are many of us here. Parents."
Ellie glanced outside. The reporters were still congregated in the street, talking among themselves and waiting for the press conference, but it was the line of people that caught her attention. "Parents. There had to be 100 of them."
"Please," said a man standing on the steps. "You threw us out with the press, but we need to talk to you. Some of us have come a long way."
"Of course I'll talk to you," Ellie said. "One at a time, though. Pass the word down the line. We'll be here all night if we need to."
While the news was being spread, Ellie heard several women burst into quiet sobs. She shut the door as gently as she could. Steeling herself, she headed back to her desk and took her seat. "Sit down," she said, indicating the two chairs in front of the desk. "Penelope," she said, "you can interview people, too. Just take down names, contact numbers, and any information they have."
"Sure, Chief."
Peanut immediately headed for the door. "Now," Ellie said, leaning forward, "tell me about your daughter." Grief stared back at her, stark as blood on snow. Dr. Stern was the first to speak. "Our Ruthie left for school one day and never arrived there. It was two blocks from our house. I called the policeman who has been our friend in this, and he tells me this girl you have found cannot be our Ruthie. I tell him our people believe in miracles, so we've come here to see you." He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small, worn photograph. In it, a beautiful little girl with sandy brown ringlets held onto a bright pink Power Rangers lunchbox. The date in the lower right corner was September 7th, 1996. Today, Ruthie would be at least 13, maybe 14. Ellie took a deep breath. It was impossible not to think suddenly of the line of hopeful parents outside, all of them waiting for a miracle. This would be the longest day of her life. Already she wanted to cry. She took the photo, touched it. When she looked up again, Mrs. Stern was weeping. "Ruthie's blood type?"
"Oh,"
Mrs. Stern said, wiping her eyes and waiting.
"I'm sorry," Ellie said. "So very sorry."
Across the room, Peanut opened the door. Another couple walked in, clutching a color photograph to their chest.
"Please, God,"
Ellie prayed, closing her eyes for just a moment, a heartbeat.
"Let me be strong enough for this."
Then Mrs. Stern started to talk.
"Horses," she said in a throaty voice. "She loved horses, our Ruthie. We thought she wasn't old enough for lessons. Next year, we always said. Next year."
Dr. Stern touched his wife's arm.
"And then, this."
He took the picture from Ellie, staring down at it. Tears brightened his eyes. He looked up, finally.
"You have children, Chief Barton?"
"No."
Ellie thought he was going to say something to that, but he remained silent, helping his wife to her feet.
"Thank you for your time, Chief."
"I'm sorry,"
she said again.
"I know," he said,
and Ellie could see suddenly how fragile he was, how hard he was working to keep his composure. He took his wife's arm and steered her to the door. They left. A moment later, a man walked in. He wore a battered, patched pair of faded overalls and a flannel shirt. An orange steel chainsaw baseball cap covered his eyes, and a gray beard consumed the lower half of his face. He clutched a photograph to his chest. It was of a blonde cheerleader, Ellie could see from here.
"Chief Barton," he said in a hopeful voice.
"That's me," she answered. "Please, come sit down."
10. Last night, Julia had transformed her girlhood bedroom into a safety zone for her and her patient. The two twin beds still graced the left wall, but now the spaces beneath them were filled to block hiding places. In the corner by the window, she'd gathered almost one dozen tall potted plants and created a mini forest. A long formica table took up the center of the room, serving as a desk and study space. Two chairs sat tucked up beside it. Now, however, she realized what she'd missed: a comfortable chair.
For the past 6 hours, the child had stood at the barred open window with her arm stuck outside. Come rain or shine, she held her hand out there. Somewhere around noon, a robin had landed on the windowsill and stayed there. Now, in the pale gray sunlight that followed the last hour's rain, a brightly colored butterfly landed on her outstretched hand, fluttering there for the space of a single breath, then flew off. If Julia hadn't written it down, she would have stopped believing she'd seen it. After all, it was autumn, hardly the season for butterflies, and even in the full heat of summer, they rarely landed on a little girl's hand, not even for an instant. But she had written it down, made a note of it in the permanent file. And so there it was now. A fact to be considered, another oddity among the rest. Perhaps it was the girl's stillness. She hadn't moved in hours. Not a shifting of her weight, not a changing of her arm, not a turn of her head. Not only did she evidence no repetitive or obsessive movements, she was as still as a chameleon. The social worker who had come this morning to conduct the home study to determine Julia's fitness as a temporary foster parent had been shocked, though she tried to hide it. As she closed her notebook, the woman had thrown a last worried glance at the girl before whispering to Julia, "Are you sure?" "I am," Julia had said. And she was. Helping this child had already become something of a quest. Last night, after preparing the bedroom, she had stayed up late, sitting at the kitchen table, making notes, and reading everything she'd been able to find on the few true wild children on record. It was both fascinating and wrenchingly sad. Their cases all followed a similar pattern, whether they'd been found 300 years ago in the dense woods of Bavaria or in this century in the wilds of Africa. All of them were discovered, usually by hunters, hiding in deep, dark forests. More than a third of them ran on all fours. Very few had been able to speak. Several of them, including Peter the Wild Boy in 1726, Memmi the so-called Savage Girl in France, and most famously Victor the Wild Boy of Aveyron in 1797, had become media sensations in their day. Scientists and doctors and language theorists flocked to their sides, each hoping their wild child would answer the most elemental human nature questions. Kings and princesses brought them to court as oddities, entertainments. The most recent case, that of a girl named Jeannie, who, though not raised in the wild, had been subjected to such systematic and horrific abuse that she had never learned to speak or move around or play, was yet another case of media attention. Most